So we begin what we call the Ma'amar Sheni, the second section. Well, I see they translate it there, the second essay. What does your book call it?
The second gate.
Second gate. Oh, yeah. Okay, all the same idea. So we refer back to the beginning of the Sefer, which actually started with a story where the king of Khuzar had been sensing, he was a very dedicated member of the Khuzar religion, but he began sensing that with all of his efforts and all of his dedication to Khuzar rites and religion, it wasn't getting him where he needed to be. And he actually had a dream in which he was told, yes, your intent is in the right place, but you're going about it in the wrong way. Don't know. Now, it could be that it really just means that he was sensing it. Now, so he began his search. We're beginning the second ma'amar, because I kind of like the second chelik. We're referring back to the beginning of the story. So he began his search, which brought him to the philosophers, to the Christians, to the Muslims, until he finally found the Jewish sage who he engaged with discussion that we've been seeing up till now. So that there was different opinions about. I don't want to get into that now. All the way at the beginning, it's subject to debate. Now, so now we move on to the next part of the story. After he had this whole discussion, in which up till now, really, the Khuzari was basically just presenting the basics of our faith. This is Judaism as a package. So the next step was, Va'acharei chein, afterwards, Haya me'inyin ha-Khuzari ma'ashu noida b'sifrei Khuzar. What happened with the Khuzari king was what is well publicized in the books of Khuzar. That he had told his dream to his general, I guess this is his highest, closest official. And the dream kept coming to him. Meaning the next stage, after he was having this, he had his initial dream, which told him that you're not in the right direction, go look for it, and he found this Jewish chacham. The next stage was that he started having these dreams that if he wants to really be able to connect to the right way, he should go to the Harsan Mountains, whatever that is. All Khuzar, I understand, is kind of in the Turkey, Uzbekistan region. Velechtam Shnehem. So the two of them went together. Hamelech v'sar tzva'oy elohorim ahim. To those mountains. I'll just say again, in a general way, we mentioned this back at the beginning of the Sefer. There was definitely a kingdom of Khuzars who were Gerim in a collective way. Whether this is actually the story, or whether the Mechaber, the author of this Sefer, is simply drawing on that historic fact to present his narrative, but it's actually fictional, is again subject to debate. So this isn't necessarily meant to be a true story. Might be fiction. Whatever it is, again, it's like when you see novels based on historic facts. So whatever it is, they went together, the king and the general. They went to those mountains, Asher Bamidbar al Hayam, that are in the desert near the sea. Ve'achigiu balayla al oisa ma'ara. And they came at night. They reached that cave at night. Shayushayusim l'sham anoshim ha'yehudim b'chol Shabbos. And there were Jews residing there who actually kept Shabbos, maybe the Shabbos that he's been hearing about. He's actually seeing it live now. Meaning up till now it was all theoretical. Yes, he met this one Jewish chacham, but he had never really connected with a real Jewish life. And yes, then the king and this close official of his came into them. And they joined their Torah. And they actually did milah. They had themselves circumcised in their cave. And then he went back home. But now their heart was in the Jewish faith. Vayomastirim emunosam. But they didn't rush out and broadcast their change in life. They kept it quiet. Ad sheyischak mo legalei soida ma'at ma'at liktas anoshim iskulosam. They wanted to do it very gradually, slowly but surely. Select the right people to tell them what's going on, get them used to the idea, have them with them, and then tell a few more people, and gradually start spreading it. They just come do it in one shot, different dynamics and different ministers, etc. So they chose who they're going to tell when, carefully, until slowly, working little by little, and in privacy, they won over many of the key people. Ad sherabu, until they felt that there's already enough key, influential people who are a part of this secret. V'gilu matzpunam, and then they let it out into the open, they broadcasted it. V'ischazku al she'eris hakuzarim. Once they were at that point, it was easy for them to prevail over the rest of the nation. V'ichnisum b'toiras hayehudim. And they all joined the Jewish faith. And they imported Jewish chachamim and sfarim from all around, and they learned Torah. And the truth is, this is a clearly established historic fact that there was a Khuzar kingdom of Jews. And now, all kinds of other stories also about their successes, their military campaigns. If you're interested in just knowing more about this kingdom, and the different special discoveries that they made about things that had been unknown hitherto, and how they gathered very, very great crowds, hundreds of thousands of people who were loyally dedicated to the Torah. Imavosam bat Torah v'kosvam obeis hamikdash. It turned into a whole nation, a whole country of people who loved the Torah, were longing for the Beis Hamikdash. Ad sheikimu tavnis hamishkan asher osa Moshe. To the extent that they actually built a model mishkan, like what Moshe had done. I would guess that they made sure to do this al pi halacha. There are things in the Mishkan that you're not allowed to build exactly as it is, but whatever it is, this was how they were showing their longing. And now again, this was a nation of Gerim. They used to respect, revere biological Jews. They considered it a blessing to associate with them and to have what to do with them. They were considered the elite in this country, a privileged class. Kasha nizka b'sifreim, like you see in their books. What's that?
Is this part true, or is this that we're not sure if it's part?
So again, this is based on historical fact. Whether the actual way he's putting it down, I don't know, but it definitely was a Khuzar kingdom of Gerim. / Jews. You're talking about approximately in the 700s AC. There was such a kingdom. They didn't last very long. Maybe they lasted for a few hundred years, but ultimately they were overtaken by others. But there definitely was such a kingdom. And again, like we discussed back at the beginning, this sefer is either an actual account of things that happened there, or he was just drawing on these general historic facts to present his story, but it's not necessarily actually meant to be an accurate depiction. There are different opinions on that. But he's using it as the background for his story, for his sefer. We're at the second chelik. We're starting the second chelik. It's kind of like the continuation of the story. The first story was the initial discussion he had with the Jewish sage. And now we're at the next stage where he actually took the ball and ran with it.
He's convinced?
Yeah. He's very convinced. He actually ultimately got his whole nation involved. Now, because Shalom Adam Melech HaTorah, Misifrei Anavim, now as he got involved in learning Torah and Sifrei Nevim. Rokach hachover ahu l'rav. So again, now he's already a full-fledged Jew, he's a ger. He took that sage to be his rav, his rebbe, by a shoyelos ha-she'elos ivrios, and he would ask him all kinds of Jewish questions. Now again, presenting up till now what we saw was really what we'll call presenting the faith in a basic way. But now we're talking about people who are already inside and want to grow, want to go further. It's already not an issue of defending the faith or selling the faith. We're just going to move deeper into Judaism. Now the first thing he asked him was, he asked him about all the different names and descriptions and adjectives that we see attributed to Hashem. To the extent that some things actually denote physicality. Right? See, in the Torah, we're just talking a very simple level. Hashem's eyes, Hashem's hand, Hashem's arm, right? But even besides that, different descriptions of what the Nevi'im say they saw, the form of a man, an old man, a young man. And even besides that, all kinds of different, what you might call, moods by Hashem. Or different adjectives, different feelings kiviyachol that Hashem has, which sound human. So he wanted to understand this. Even though attributing anything human-like to Hashem is it doesn't make sense logically. And the Torah itself very clearly in many places makes it clear that no, there's nothing physical or human-like about Hashem. So we have to put it all together. So now, this is what we're going to get into this discussion about. How are we to understand the different descriptions of Hashem?
When was the Rambam?
What's that? Rambam was approximately the 1100s. 1200s, I'm sorry. I think it was the early 1200s, but I'm not sure. The Rambam was presumably a bit after this. But, no, this Sefer was written about the 1100s. The story of the Kuzars was in the 700s. That's right, this Sefer was Lamaisa written 400 years after the events would have transpired if they were true.
The sources that you're referring to, not comparing Hashem to anything physical or anything human or both.
Well, let's see. That's where we have a whole discussion ahead of us. Let's see. What's that? Well, the truth is that the Rambam was one sefer of a strain of Sfarim, among which the Kuzari is right up there. We'll just go back, since we're getting more into it now, we'll go back and review just some of the basic things that we saw about the Sefer Kuzari back at the beginning. The truth is that, yes, when it comes to Jewish thought, all these in Yonim, there are a few Sfarim. Yes, Rambam is right up there, but the Kuzari is up there with the Rambam. And may have presumably preceded him. Kuzari was Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, who was a son-in-law of Ibn Ezra. It was all around approximately the same time. Maybe it was a bit older than the Rambam. I'm not sure exactly. But it was all around approximately around the same time. Now, as we'll note, the Sefer Kuzari was actually recommended by the Gedolei Hadoros more broadly than the Rambam was, meaning the Rambam's books on philosophy were the Rambam, right? But the Rambam got into areas that subsequently the Mekubalim came along and said that certain aspects of what the Rambam wrote, trying to approach it from a Hashkafic aspect, from a Hashkafic angle. The Rambam and the Kuzari, and this was a general period of great Jewish philosophy. Kavi Salvavus was also from this period. The Ralbag was from this period.
Probably Zohar.
What's that?
Where does the Zohar fit in?
Oh, and Zohar first appeared on the scene a couple of hundred years later. Now, so basically this was a period that was by and large without Kabbalah. It was Kabbalah in a very, very small line. Very limited line. Very not available to the public. Most people weren't exposed to it. and the general, even among the Gedolei Yisrael, the general mainstream of Jewish thought did not include Kabbalah at all. Yeah, the Ramban, who was also an approximate contemporary of these people, had his Kabbalah from the Raivin, Rabbeinu Israel, etc., etc. But it was a very, very specific line that wasn't for the masses. Even many of the Gedolei Yisrael passed them by. I'm not implying anything. I'm still putting it together. 1 minute. I want to put this delicately. Now, so again, most of the philosophies found that we have written by the Gedolei Yisrael of that period were not based on Kabbalah. They weren't based on Kabbalah because it wasn't there. Reb Shimshon Pinkus puts this into a very hush of a perspective. We have to understand what the Pshatan is. Sfarim like, again, Reb Sadi Goin, right? Very, very fundamental Sfarim in Jewish faith. Reb Sadi Goin, the Rambam, this, the Kuzari, the Chovos HaLevavos. So many of these Sfarim are basically nothing to do with Kabbalah. So basically, the way Reb Shimshon Pinkus explains this is, and I'm putting it into my own words, is that there was... The way the Chovos HaLevavos puts it is that there are a few Mekoiris, a few different sources of Emes. Emes can come from the direct line of tradition, right? The things you actually receive from those before you. He also says that the product of the pure, unbiased human mind pushed to its maximum is a Mekor of Emes. It's a source of truth. You can learn truth from there, and it's authoritative. A lot of examples. This is something that really deserves a lot of discussion. We're not going to give it a lot of discussion right now. But yes, the human mind is a very, very great source of generating wisdom. That's how Avraham Avinu put together all of Judaism that way. Just by a prolific mind, a thinking mind. Now, people of the philosophical age can more identify with this concept when the minds were really prolific, just producing and producing and producing. Today we don't use that much of our minds. The truth is that a person who's trained to learning Torah uses his mind a lot more than most people in the world do. But to just be drawing from the depths of your mind, which we all have, just often lies dormant. So, there was a period in which Torah was meant to be developed through that medium. Without the Kabbalah. Without the Kabbalah. Hashem gave that mission. Not in an official way, right? But that was actually the mission of these unbelievably great, immense periods with these immense personalities like the Rambam, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, Ibn Ezra, Reb Sadia Goin, Chovos HaLevavos, etc. So Hashem did not want Kabbalah in that period because we want to have the Torah HaSeichel, right? The Torah produced by that pure Jewish intellect. Okay. Now later, not very long afterwards, Zohar appeared on the scene, which already started, Kabbalah started becoming a little bit more. Ultimately, at the time of the Arizal, there was an explosion of Kabbalah. Kabbalah was mamish put into the world in a very, very big influx. And since then the Kubbalim came and ruled, right? This is true, this is not true, etc. And basically what happened at that point was that retroactively, things had to be reanalyzed. Now there are a lot of points of disagreement between these different Sfarim. Let's say Rambam and Kuzari, etc. Or points of contention. Some points caused a lot of controversy. Different philosophical points about Jewish faith. But ultimately, Kabbalah basically came along and said, basically laid things down, and like you couldn't really argue with it because this was based on things that were actually seen and experienced. So, what ended up was, and I'll just, again, this is something that can be discussed a lot, probably better not discussed at all because we have to be very careful when we touch these things, but basically what ended up was that one of the great people of that time said, he named three people, three very famous Jewish philosophers, Kuzari, the Rambam, and the third one, who I'm not going to name now, and he said, Divrei HaRambam Krovim Ela Emes Yotzei Min HaSheker. The Rambam is much closer to truth than falsehood. Divrei, the other party, Krovim Ela Sheker Yotzei Min HaEmes, more goes and leans in the direction of falsehood than truth. Divrei HaKuzari Kulam Emes. Whereas the words of the Khazari are all true. Meaning, what's that? I don't know who it is. It's something that's quoted. It's something that's quoted by many of the great authorities of earlier generations, so I take it on their authority. This is something that has been quoted in an authoritative way by many of the Kadmoin. So, if we want to corroborate this with what the Gra said, the Gra recommended learning, for example, instead of learning Merlin Vuchim and Shah Yichud of the Chavis Alvavis. So, Chavis Alvavis, very profound sefer, which everybody has to know. But there's that first Shah Yichud, in which he establishes the basis of Judaism in a philosophical way. So the Gaon said, instead of learning that, you're better off learning Khuzari and Das Lunas of the Ramchal. Because that, basically, all of Khuzari was corroborated by the Mekubalim. Everything he said was right on. Nothing controversial, nothing questionable, nothing that there's room to wonder about. Everything he said was right on. Whatever he says, you can swallow. Without having to wonder about it. Well, we do know that there were points that the Rambam made that were contested by the great people of later generations. So that's basically, that's why Adrab, we say that Rav Hirsch also has very interesting essays in which he defines what it is about the Khuzari that grants him that unique status among the immense personalities of that generation. So that's why Adaraba, the truth is an answer to the question that was raised before. It was better not for him not to refer him to the Sefer Rambam and actually compose the Sefer HaKhuzari.
When you have sefers made by anonymous people and quoted by other people, and they're talking about people of a previous generation of whom we're told were on a higher level, then it's like, who said it? You know, it's like, shouldn't I be like wondering who is the speaker?
Yes, but let's say someone like the Vilna Gaon, for argument's sake, quotes it. That means that he believes that this is true. So who cares who said it? We're interested in the content. We're not interested in history.
And then there was someone who came later and said about the Vilna Gaon that he was on a level of the Rishonim.
Okay, I don't know. That's not really our subject right now. These things get confusing. But this is something that basically has been corroborated across the board of the later authorities. That's what we call Basroi. They have the krach of coming afterwards and making the hachra'ah of what Lamaisa is accepted as the halacha in Hilchas Deis, if we'll call it that. There's halachas of Shabbos, right, in which the Shulchan Aruch came and codified the discussions of all the great people who were before him, who he said he doesn't compare to at all, but he's Lamaisa summing it up and tying it all together. It's the same thing in Hilchas Deis. The later authorities come and tie it up and say, this is halacha.
And when they do that, do we then look back and say, oh, the other ones who said differently are in error?
I don't know. Think of it how you want.
I mean, we have to make our own view, so if that's...
I mean, for our purposes, we don't need any more then. The Khuzari is a great sefer to know. That's all. Good enough. You're going into dangerous territory. I don't want to go with you there. We're talking about people who are beyond anything we can comprehend. Okay. So now, he chooses to start his discussion with what we'll call attributes of Hashem. Now, to us it might kind of sound technical. How do we understand these different expressions? But the truth is that this is very fundamental. This is how he's beginning his discussion as a member of the Jewish faith. I mean, up till now, he was studying what Judaism is. Now he's a Jew, which means that he has to start performing as a Jew. Performing as a Jew includes thinking as a Jew needs to think, having the right consciousness that a Jew needs to have. So therefore, he starts from the most fundamental place. I have a relationship with Hashem. A very fundamental element of that relationship is knowing who Hashem is. According to many Rishonim, it's actually included in the mitzvah of Emunah, to try to have as good of an understanding of Hashem as you can, which is going to be scraping the iceberg, obviously, and as we'll see soon, actually most of it is defining what Hashem is not. Sounds a little cryptic right now, but we'll see soon. It's very, very practical, and that knowing what Hashem is not will give us a very, very great picture of the greatness of Hashem. But that's where he's starting. I'm starting with a relationship with Hashem. The most basic element of that is, who is Hashem? How am I supposed to relate to Him? If you have a completely distorted picture of Hashem, that can be a very serious error in Emunah, and therefore he wants to work this out. For example, somebody who thinks that Hashem is a physical form, just he's really big, is lacking in a very basic element of Emunah. So what happens if a person doesn't think that Hashem has a physical form, but he thinks that Hashem has, is subject to mood swings, like a human? That might not be as blatant a problem of Emunah as believing that he actually has big arms, but that might also be a problem of Emunah. You're misunderstanding what Hashem is. And what happens if you don't think that Hashem has mood swings, but you do think that you can influence the way he thinks, you can convince him of things? They were getting even a little subtler. I'm not answering these questions yet. I'm just showing why this is a very important discussion. This is a discussion that is actually a more subtle level of actual Emunah. Emunah is believing that there is Hashem, but the next level is understanding who Hashem is. For example, if you think Hashem, what's that?
He didn't get this from realizing and understanding how Hashem took the throne and shaped this nation and everything that the cover.
Oh, that shows us an awful lot about Hashem's greatness, but it still doesn't give us the whole picture. Meaning, let me ask you that question: is Hashem subject to moods? Can you infer that from Yetzias Mitzrayim? Is Hashem sometimes in a better mood and sometimes in a worse mood?
He seems that he couldn't put up with the treatment.
Oh, so there's a good question. Is Hashem affected by distress? Are there things that Hashem can't handle? At first glance, it would actually seem that yes, from the story of Mitzrayim. But that might actually be a problem in Emunah and understanding what Hashem is.
Do we have in Parshas Bala? Bilam knew when Hashem got angry.
So you're asking, you are furthering the question here. So let's see. So again, I'm not answering these questions. I'm just raising the question. For example, someone who thinks that Hashem could come into this world as a human being and then be nailed to a cross, that's again, that person believes in Hashem, but he's got a serious problem. Or someone believes in an angry, vicious Hashem that was represented by Mohammed, also might believe in Hashem, but he's got the wrong picture. Hashem says, that's who you think I am. You should be thrown out the window. So if you believe in Hashem, but you think of Him in a denigrating way for Him, that's a bit of a problem too. So that's why it's very important. That's why he chooses this as his first discussion. How are we supposed to understand all these different things? So Amar HaKhover, and the truth is this also, a lot of this Sfarim spent time on this subject. Omer HaChover, the Chover says, I'll just give two more examples just to understand where we're going with this. We say that Hashem is merciful. Sounds complimentary, right? But maybe you can approach it from another angle, which the Sfarim actually do. Mercy, in a sense, is a form of weakness. The truth is, any characteristic that controls you that you can't control is a form of weakness, right? Cruelty is certainly a form of weakness, right? But mercy is a much better form of weakness than cruelty. But when a person just can't bear to do whatever it is. So again, in the case of a person, we might call that a sensitive, fine person. But when you talk about Hashem, can you say he can't bear to? But at the same time, we're told that he's merciful. Right? For example, we're told, don't you ever say that the reason for the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKein, right? You see a mother with its chicks. Don't take the eggs while the mother is there. Send the mother off. The Gemara tells us, a person who says, oh, look at the Rachamei Hashem. Meaning Hashem couldn't handle seeing the mother go through the tzar. Hashem is, he has mercy on the mother and therefore he gave this mitzvah. Chazal say, if someone says such a thing, you shut him up. Right? Why? Because what are you saying? Like, you have the capability of making Hashem nauseous, right? If you scratch on a blackboard, it makes Hashem nauseous. If you take the eggs while the baby is there, it distresses Hashem. Hashem can't handle that. Hashem created a reality that wolves tear birds apart in a much crueler way. And Hashem can handle that. So, it's actually considered a slight to Hashem to say such a thing. So, how do we put it all... But yet at the same time, It's a very basic understanding that Hashem is merciful. But yet for a person to feel mercy and he can't overcome it. So let's see, we'll have to put it all together. So Amar HaChavah. HaChavah says, Shemois HaBoirei Kulam, Chutz Me HaMefayrosh, all names of Hashem, except for the Shem HaMefayrosh, Shud Kei Vav Kei, which as far as we're concerned, just denotes his ultimate existence. Heim Midois VeTavniois Tiflios are nothing but fringe attributes or modes of behavior. Nilkachos mehef elios habruim loy kefigzeros avomasov, which are really based only on how he relates to us. Meaning, let's say you see a judge implementing justice. He does his job well. Let me give this mashal soon. So, will you say that he's a just person? People might say that he's a just person, but the truth is not necessarily so. You don't know what he's like on a personal level. On a personal level, he might not be a just person at all. Just when he's on the bench, wants to do a good job, so his mode of behavior is very just. So he implements justice. He's not. It doesn't necessarily mean that he's a just person. Lahavdil, we're saying about Hashem, that all the different things that we say about him are the modes of action that we see him doing in this world, but they don't necessarily reflect on who he essentially is. Let's see. Nikro Rachum. When we call him merciful, that doesn't mean that Hashem has a merciful nature. What does it mean? Kshometakin inyin mishahayu bnei adam merachmim alav l'ra'ayin yanoi. When you see a person in a downtrodden state, and Hashem comes along and fixes up his whole situation, we saw mercy manifest. Right? We saw mercy implemented. So we say rachum about Hashem. What that means is we observed mercy. But again, that doesn't necessarily mean that that's Hashem's nature. What is Hashem's nature? Well, we'll see soon. If there's anything we can say about Hashem's nature. The first thing he's saying is that, no, to say that Hashem is merciful, inherently, say that he's inherently merciful, that that's his nature, is actually, surprisingly enough, a sacrilege. You can't say that because you don't know what Hashem is like. You can't know what Hashem is like. You see him implementing mercy. So when we see Hashem acting in that way, we attribute to him mercy and graciousness. However, now listen to this, he puts this down very starkly, as many of the other Kadmonim do. The truth is that what is a nature of mercy? Chalishus ha-nefesh ve-hemoyas ha-teva. It is a weakness of character, which again, in general, will be a profitable weakness, but it's a weakness of character, something that there's so much a person can do, right? You just can't overcome certain feelings. And it's an emotion that a person can't overcome. I can't bear to do this. That's what natural mercy is. So again, when you're talking about natural characteristics, since we're all born with a spread of natural characteristics, it's certainly a better weakness. But at the end of the day, it's a weakness that we cannot attribute to Hashem. We can't say that Hashem is just, you know, emotional and he can't overcome these feelings. Ein ze roi lo yisbar. We can't say that about Hashem. Aval omnam hu shefet tzedek. No, Hashem judges righteously according to his discretion. Goyzer berish odam echon, va'oysher odam acher, mibli sheyishtare be'atzmusay. Hashem might decide that that person will be poor, and that person will be rich, without feeling any differently about this person than that person. Meaning you're not seeing any change in Hashem. When he looked at that person, he got annoyed, so therefore he made him poor. When he looked at that person, he felt good, so that's why he made him rich. No. We're talking about what we're going to call, meanwhile, a cold system. That's what we're going to call it, meanwhile. A cold system in which Hashem has criteria that he works with. This person needs to be rich. This person needs to be poor. And there isn't any feeling involved. He doesn't feel mercy to one person and feel anger to the other. Anger, once again, is an emotion that controls you. Nothing controls Hashem. Mercy is an emotion that controls you. Nothing controls Hashem. V'anachnu roim kezeh b'shoftei b'nei adam. And yes, as we just said, you see this by human judges. Sheshayal imoysen b'dinim. V'danim. B'mashich mechayeves ha-toyo. When you see a judge implementing the law that should be implemented, v'yu anoshim zoichim b'din, v'achemim chayovim, you see, that person he vindicates, that person he convicts. Now it's all coming from the judge, yet, but we won't say that there's anything changing. The judge was in a different mood yesterday than today, because yesterday he convicted the guy, today he vindicated the guy. No, there's no mood change. He has a clear set of rules. He's in exactly the same state of mind, and he's acting very graciously with that person, and very harshly with the other person, without any change of state, and without any change of feeling. Right? V'chein Hashem yisbarach. The same goes with Hashem. Pam yikorei kel rachum v'chan. Sometimes he'll be called a merciful and gracious God. Or pam yikorei kel kanei v'noike. Sometimes he'll be called a jealous and vengeful God. V'u yisbarach einenu mishtane mimido el mido. But Hashem is not actually changing from one state to another. What is it? We'll see soon. Right now he's saying what it's not. The bottom line being, all the different attributes, all the different adjectives that we use about Hashem, outside of the Shem HaMefarosh, Yud Kei Vav Kei, which is more intrinsic, they divide into three categories. There are either things that we call Hashem that are practical, meitiv, right? Hashem is good, meaning that he bestows goodness. That's something practical. It's based on facts. We saw him bestowing goodness, so we say that he bestows goodness. So we call him a meitiv, right? Or they're adjectives that just denote abstract greatness. For example, you say Hashem is gadol, he's great. That's not based on any practical behavior, right? There's no action that's called great. Or you say that he's kadosh, he's holy. There's no action that's called great. These are just adjectives of trying to impress upon our mind how immense he is, right? So, again, it's either practical attributes, adjectives, or shayluvios. This is the most interesting one. Well, we'll see. Or, actually, negative expressions. Meaning, well, we'll see soon what we mean. By shayluvios, it means, well, the example that we'll see soon is that we say Hashem is chai. Hashem is life. Now, however you define life, doesn't really fit for Hashem. So as it says soon, when we say he's chai, really the point is that he's not dead. But what life for Hashem means is something we have no idea what. It's not life in any sense that we know it. Hashem doesn't run on a heart. So therefore, chai is what we might call, how do you say, not negative, but like, to say lafuke, like the opposite of. We say chai to denote that he's not dead. Or we'll see all the such examples. So now let's see. So first we have the practical attributes that we attribute to him, which come from what we see him doing. We say Hashem is Mayri Shumashir. He makes poor and he makes rich. He lowers some and raises up others. He's merciful and gracious. He's jealous and vengeful. Gibor, he's mighty. Nodi, he's generous. Other such things. These are things that actually denote things that we saw him doing, right? But again, he's not saying that this is Hashem's nature. Then we have adjectives that are just kind of creating a certain impression without actually pinpointing anything specific that he does. We say that he's blessed. Mehulo, he is lauded. Kadosh, he's holy. Ram v'nisa, he's high and exalted. Now all these things are simply our attempts to try to express our feelings about him, about how great he is. But it doesn't really define him in any specific way. What does it mean he's hot? What does that mean? It means that, well, he's up there. How high? Is it an issue of altitude? So obviously high is just a form of trying to express how figuratively high he is, right? It's all figurative. What does holy mean exactly? What does it mean that he's lauded, blessed? So therefore, in the rabbis, even though we see many such names, they certainly do not indicate in any way any sort of multifacetedness about Hashem. No, Hashem is completely uniform. Just, we have all kinds of, we're trying to find the right words, so we come up with a lot of great words. And then we have the more negative ones, the ones that are coming to say what he isn't. Kimoi chai ve'echad rishon ve'achron. We say that he's alive. We say that he's one. We say that he's the first, and we say that he's the last. Right? The supa el olav be'ele kedei lishlam imenu hefchon. Really, the only reason we use these words is to say that he's not the opposite of these things. That's really the point. But it's not to describe him as one. One itself is something definable. Hashem is completely undefinable. He's not a unit. He's just infinite. See, he's not even one. He's just everything. It's just loy lekayim loy ele al haderech shanachnu mevinim mehem. When we say yes that he's live, he's one, he's the first, he's the last, it doesn't mean in the way that we might say that about a human, in the way we could relate to it. As far as we're concerned, what does life mean? How do you define life? Who's alive? Alive means something that feels, something that grows, right? However you'll define it. Vais alamehem. Hashem is certainly above these things. Vanachno oimrim alav shu chai. So why do we say that he's alive? Lishlam imenu hamaves. Just to point out that he's not dead. Meaning the philosophers kind of thought that Hashem was a dead system. If you remember, we saw back at the beginning. Something that runs automatically, there's no consciousness there. That's kind of a way of saying, no, Hashem is a conscious, active, living being. But not that he qualifies for the definition of life in the way we know life to be. In our mind, everything is either dead or alive. So if you have to choose one of the two about Hashem, it's obviously alive. But it's still nothing to do with any concept of life that we have. Live, he says, means something mortal, something that can die. If it's not dead, the state of not being dead is alive. By Hashem, the whole thing just isn't relevant. He can't die. So that means that life is not anything defined. What's that? Bios it is, right? So that's why we use that term. It says, like, for example, have something that just aren't relevant. It's a stone. If you say a stone is not wise, does that mean that it's dumb? No. It's not dumb, because the concept of intellect just doesn't apply to a stone. If you say that a stone is not wise, it doesn't mean that it's a fool. It just isn't relevant. So really, life as live as opposed to dead, it's just really not relevant to Hashem. Just like a stone is under the radar of wisdom or foolishness, so too the essence of Hashem is simply above the concept of life or death. Just like Hashem is neither light nor dark. He's neither light nor dark. Even though we'll talk about Hashem in terms of light, but that doesn't mean that Hashem shines. Hashem is neither light nor dark. But if we have to talk about one or the other, we'll call him light, because he's not dark. Right? If someone would ask us, is Hashem an essence of light or dark? We'll say in a figurative way, light. Because he's certainly not dark. Dark means just void. Hashem is not a void, so therefore we say he's light. But he's not light either.
So what's the point of using all these inapplicable terms?
For us. That's the point. For us. That's the point. For us. That's the point. For us. What are you going to say? What? So you're going to write? It just gets a little too wordy. It just gets a little too wordy. You're going to say every time the one we don't know about? When you're relating to Hashem, you have to talk about him. Practical. He's being practical. It's really just an issue of practicality. The one we don't know about. The one we don't know about gave me this. You could say that in a Hanami. Right? You know, Kabbalat Mikubalim called an Eitzai. That's also a legitimate usage. It just might be a little impractical. They're saying, yes, we do have these usages. And they're legitimate as long as you realize that it's just a form of speech for us. But you're right. If you want to go around calling Hashem the one we don't know about, that's fine also. That is fine. Let the Mikubalim call him Ein Saif. Right?
So if we want to ask ourselves, is Hashem wise? We could either say he's wise or he's, let's say, the opposite.
So obviously we say he's wise. Well, the truth is that the concept of wisdom doesn't apply to Hashem either, as we'll discuss. Meaning
Torah,
the point here
is the Torah and Hashem are one. Is Torah not wisdom?
So in other words, coming back to the question that he's asking, right? We call Hashem wise. Why do you need to come on to that? There are psukim that say that Hashem is wise, and there are psukim that say that Hashem is live, and there are psukim that say that Hashem is light. And yet we're saying that the intent of all those things is that he's not the opposite. Aval ala emes yesh lanu loyma shein mekabel ha'or v'achoshech ala gufos ha'tiviyos. So really, as far as we're concerned, if you want to really understand it, you can use all these terms as long as you understand the truth. And the truth is that Hashem simply is not relevant to any of these things. Ha'etzem elokei einenu guf. Hashem is not a body, meaning he's not a human constitution, not even on the emotional level. Alken lo yisupa ba'or ela derech dimyon. And therefore, when we talk about light, it's just in a figurative way. Oylishlo mimenu hamido apchuso. It's either in a figurative way or to say that he's not the opposite. Also, life and death is only relevant to physical bodies. Where Hashem simply supersedes all that. Yes, we will use the word live to denote that he's conscious, he's not like the philosopher's thought, a dead system. The point is, we can't relate to any form of life other than the life that we know. And therefore, yes, it's our way of saying we don't know what he is. We know that he's not dead, and therefore we call him life. It's a way of saying we don't know what he is. Umasha oimer keil chai velikim chaim. And yes, when we say he's a keil chai, he's a likim chaim. Really, the point is just to contrast him with the other deities who are dead gods. Hashem is, they're dead gods. Hashem is a live god. Because they can't do anything. Okay. This has been a bit abstract. As we'll go along, we'll bring it down, Bezus Hashem, into more practical terms. But the truth is that this system is actually learning what Hashem is not can be very effective in giving us a bigger picture of the greatness of Hashem, rather than describing what Hashem actually is, which is basically impossible. But we'll see.